listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Hello, book lovers. You are listening to Words and Nerds podcast with Danny and Chris as your hosts. We chat to authors about their writing and discuss how social and political influences help shape their work. Our aim is to have a relaxed but in-depth conversation where we take the writing, but never ourselves, too seriously. If you like the podcast, it would be wonderful if you left a review on iTunes. The best reviews, or ones that make us laugh, will get a shout out on the podcast. If you'd like us to chat to one of your favourite authors, or you'd just like to say hello, you can email wordsandnerds@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram at wordsandnerds_podcast, Facebook, Words and Nerds Podcast and Blog, and Twitter at wordsnerds. This month's shout-outs, a huge thank you to Erica Books Always on Instagram, who says thank you guys so much for starting this awesome podcast. And Katarina Sanders, also on Instagram, says Words and Nerds is my favourite podcast, wishing you guys all the best for this holiday season. We have another one from Book Lovers Delight, who's given us 5 stars. We have another one from The Other Outlier, who's given us 5 stars and said it's a book lover's delight. If you're into books and authors, this is a great podcast. Hosts are easy to listen to and have good chemistry between themselves and the guests. The hosts are easy to listen to and have a good knowledge of what they're chatting about. A good range of books and authors covered also. Keep it up. Thank you. Another one from Dana, who says such a delightful podcast. Another 5-star rating. This is such a comfortable, chatty podcast. It feels like a casual conversation between friends more than an interview. Also, I'm so glad I finally know how to pronounce James Fahey's name correctly, and that was one of my issues too. Erica Books Always also says, I just finished listening to Beverly's interview. OMG. I absolutely adore Beverly. Who doesn't? And this podcast interview made me love her even more. I loved the making of Gabrielle Davenport and A Shining in the Shadows, and I can't wait for book 3. Danny, oh my gosh, I was thinking the same thing and even wrote it down in my notes when I read A Shining and saw that Gabrielle was written in first person, unlike in the making of Gabrielle Davenport. So I'm really glad that you asked that. Paula gives us another 5 stars and says, big fans of Words and Nerds. I love the relaxed flow of conversation between Danny and Chris and the authors. Danny has very obviously done her research and interprets the storyteller's intention and direction impeccably. I love Danny's understandings of the characters and themes behind the books. Chris has an impressive general knowledge, and both hosts have a fun, open and cheeky sense of humour. They touch on many hot topics in today's society. Worth a listen. Thank you so much. It means the world to us to have such amazing reviews in our podcast. Today we welcome Australian illustrator Jules Faber. He won Book of the Year at the Australian Book Industry Awards with Ando for the first Weirdo book in 2014. They also won Best Design Book for Children and Best Cover at the Australian Book Design Awards, as well as an Honours in the Koalas 2014. Plus, Weirdo 3 has been nominated for 3 awards in 2015, and David Warner's Kaboom Kids series has been nominated for Best Design Series at the ABDAs. Jules is also an award-winning cartoonist. He's won 3 prizes in the Rotary Cartoon Awards Best Comic Strip category, coming second in 2009 and 2010, before getting first place in 2013. On top of this, Jules' talents lie in many fields, including caricature art, realistic illustration, teaching workshops, public speaking, pizza making, animation writing, and wearing sneakers. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jules. How are you?
Not so bad, thanks. Winding down for Christmas.
Yes, aren't we all? As winding up, aren't you meant to be?
No, it's winding down. It's definitely winding down.
I wind in both directions.
The first thing that I sort of was interested about when I was looking into your work, I was actually really fascinated by your work with Dr. Carl. That comes about just because I love Dr. Carl. Had a mad auntie who went to university with him who said he was fantastic fun. What was your experience like working with Dr. Carl?
It was fantastic. As a prelude, if you like, to working with Dr. Carl, I actually cite him with the reason that I got into books in the first place. Years and years ago, before I ever even considered illustrating books, I picked up one of his books And I was leaving, and they're always heavily illustrated, and leafing through it, I went, you know what, I could do this. And so a seed was planted in my head to do books. And it wasn't until many, many years later that I actually got into books by chance. And so the first thing I did was to get in touch with Dr. Carl, and we started a dialogue, and things were looking well to work together. And then he changed publishers, and it all sort of went belly up. But then we got together with, I was working with a publisher that he is with now, and he mentioned me in batches, I guess, to them, and they said, we love working with Jules. So that was that. It just sort of came about very organically and very quickly.
So it's kind of really good as well to get to work with someone who, as you said before, planted that seed for you and gave you that, that impetus to look at books.
Yeah, it sort of, it felt like it was coming full circle, you know, like my career, if you like, had finally reached a point that I was satisfied. It was a real milestone, if you like.
The other thing I really enjoyed looking at were a lot of the other comics and cartoons and stuff like that, especially my favourite one, I've been laughing about it now for about 2 weeks, was the 37th Annual Spelling Bee one on your website with the Forward Prize. I've been, every time in the last 2 weeks I've had a look at that, I've just sat there chuckling to myself nonstop. How much fun are those? Were those to do?
They were good fun. That was for my comic strip, My Brain, which years ago I did a correspondence course with the Australian School of Journalism, which I don't think even exists anymore. As it turned out, my lecturer or my tutor, it was by correspondence, as I said, so was a bloke named John Thorby, who I actually met as a member of the Australian Cartoonists Association many, many years later. That's an aside, though. But he said that the best thing that you can do is to write about something that nobody else knows, you know, your area of expertise. And and as it turned out, that was what I figured my area of expertise was, my own brain. So that became a comic strip. Yeah, so it was just ideas and musings sort of lumped together into a comic strip, which it was published in a few sort of regional papers here and there, but it was never really a commercial success, if you like. Yeah, something that I just did for fun, really.
What I like about that one is that there's an element, I think, in that one of things like Farside and Gary Larson and stuff like that in that one as well.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, the Farside is one of the two greatest comic strips of all time, or three, really, obviously, and it's enormously popular even now, like nearly 20 years after Gary Larson stopped producing it. You know, you go into any sort of stationery store or whatever, and there's the Farside calendar still there year after year. And I think that they have a real enduring humor to them, you know. They're such a pure comic, you know, that is still brilliant today. So I would definitely say that Larson has influenced that part of me in that way, because I love science and sciencey things, and so did Larson and Dr. Carl and all that too. So it was a nice little vehicle there to sort of, I don't know, show props, if you like.
Okay, so you said that's one of the best, one of the three greatest. What are the other two?
Well, Calvin and Hobbes, of course, by Bill Watterson. Probably the greatest comic strip of all time, to my mind anyway. And the other would be Peanuts.
Yes.
By Charlie Schultz. So these are household name comic strips, which isn't a commonplace thing. But, you know, there's going to be people who would be listening to this and disagreeing with that. You know, they'd be saying, oh, you've left out Doonesbury, or you've left out Garfield. So, yeah, it's that's just my opinion. Obviously, it's the right one.
So. Of course it is.
Well, going right back in time now, we started with your current work, or your most recent work, going right back to your first book. This was published in 2004, Exhibits 1 through to 33 Complete. It was a really interesting collection of short stories, cartoon and poetry. And the cartoons seem to be depictions of your life. How much of the writing was drawn from your life?
In the stories, not much. There are bits and pieces here and there, but the comic strips, certainly they were all actual things that happened to me. I was in animation at the time, and we were making a little comic, all of us, because we were all sick of drawing everybody else's, or one particular vision for a show. So we all just did our own little comic strips and banded them together and so on. But in the stories themselves, they were sort of just dark musings. They were more just like, you know, where I took an idea and just took it to extremis, you know, and went beyond sort of rational thinking, I suppose, on certain things. So yes, partially my life, but mostly not.
And the poetry, particularly poems like Confessional and Days Later?
Controversial. Well, a little bit, I suppose. But I was studying and I'd just come out of a long-term relationship and I was kind of lonely. And so, in thinking about relationships, I sort of, again, went to extremists on it and started thinking about things that happened in relationships and how things feel, and that was there was nothing true about it. It was more just a what if, which is of course a lot of what my writing is. It's what if.
Yeah, they were wonderfully dark, and they encompass the dark inner secrets of humanity and all the thoughts that we keep locked inside our minds, which actually made me feel normal, because I'm like, oh, well, other people have these strange thoughts as well. So this is going to be telling the story that really intrigued me was Peeled Darkness, where the protagonist, his thoughts turn to the possibility of being a serial killer and how some people bring out your darkness and some people bring out your light. How did this idea come to you? It was really creepy.
Thanks. That one is actually pretty true. I was in this relationship and we just moved in together, this girl and I, and after about a month, I have obsessive compulsive disorder. So I didn't know this at the time. It was just a thing. And it presented itself, like, obviously my mind was saying, this relationship isn't right for you. And it didn't know how else to tell me. And so I started having all this anxiety, and I don't sleep a lot as it is, but I started to lose sleep without realizing why. And I thought I was just having panic attacks over no reason. The doctor said, "Has anything changed in your life recently?" And I said, "Oh no, I've just moved in with my girlfriend, and we're really happy." And he said, "Well, that's a kind of big event that can actually throw you for a loop without you even realizing it." And I went, no, of course not. I'm in love. I'm happy. And so this went on for, about a year or so. So that one was sort of, again, taken to extremists, how a kernel of truth there that I just amplified and exaggerated.
Yeah, and I think that's why it spoke to me, because I was thinking back to the days when I had my newborn and he never slept, and you start having these strange, obscure thoughts, and you think, oh, my God.
I'm just watching your eyes change while you tell this story. No. I'm a little bit concerned. I'm just going to slide.
The pupils have dilated.
My favourites were Peeled Darkness, Repressional, The Art So Good, and The Jar. Oh, my God, The Jar freaked me out.
Oh, really? That's cool. I've never really heard any. I've never really talked to anyone who's read the book before. So it was a very, like, even my mother, I went up to... It was a funny story, because I'd been up to visit at some Christmas or something, and we were at we went to the pub for dinner or something like that. I can't recall where, but it was where other people were around, and Mum said something about Jules is a cartoonist or an illustrator or whatever. And I said, "Oh yeah, I'm a writer too." And the lady that we're talking to said, "Oh, what's your book like?" And I said, "Yeah, Mum, what's my book like?" And she said, "Oh,
it's very good.
It's filled with cartoons and things." And it was in that moment I knew she'd never even opened it. You know, it was, oh well. So yeah, so that was a bit. Not unexpected.
She probably read Peeled Darkness and went, "Oh my God, my son's like a mysterious."
I don't think I want to know much more.
I don't want to read anymore. Yeah. I actually found the story reminiscent of Chuck Palahniuk's Haunted, which messed with my head.
Yeah, that's actually sitting there in my to be read pile at the moment. I only recently got into Chuck's writing. It was funny because I'd always loved Fight Club. I thought it was one of the most brilliant films ever. Absolutely. And yet, when I read the book, it was really disjointed, and they did a brilliant job in making it into a a movie, which was actually more watchable, I felt, than the book was readable. So,
which never happened.
The problem, of course, being that you couldn't tell anyone that the book was bad because, you know, first rule of Fight Club, don't talk about it.
Yeah, well, that's right. It's also the second rule, but...
Well, Haunted messed with my head, as did your book, so thank you for that.
my pleasure, I guess.
I'm learning a lot here at the moment. This is a bit intriguing.
All the dark thoughts.
The veil's being torn back, yeah. ignore the man behind the curtain.
So what are your literary influences, or what famous or creative people have inspired you with your work?
Oh, look, I'm a fanboy, so I love everything, you know. It's
sound like me.
I grew up I taught myself to read when I was four, and I've just been reading ever since, avid reader, and now my daughter's the same. And so I've read, you know, tens of thousands of books. I must have by now. I couldn't really tell you how many, but early influences that I can still cite today are that I've started reading Judge Dredd when I was very young, and Judge Dredd comics, for anyone who doesn't know, from the UK, and they're a UK vision of the future of America, and it's a horrible tyranny. It's a totalitarian state, and it's actually becoming quite accurate these days. But yeah, so I've really loved that, you know, and I loved you know, Isaac Asimov and all sorts of science fiction writers, you know, Alfred Bester and Van Vo and all these guys, you know, Heinlein. You know, I grew up reading sci-fi and I loved it. Still do, although I don't read as much of it these days. But yeah, but I think I was always, like, I could never cite a single literary influence. It would be more like an illustrator and a writer working in harmony because of my love of comics and graphic novels that I've always had. And the one that leaps out at me from my childhood is 2000 AD. So I'd like to think that a lot of my stuff is inspired by them, but looking at what I do, I can't really see any reference to it. But except perhaps in some of my, you know, my comics where I've gone a little bit darker and hopefully I could one day be, you know, maybe 10% as good as, say, Brian Boland or Dave Gibbons or whatever.
Exactly. But yeah. I think personally for me, one of the things I've enjoyed over the last sort of 10, 15 years is the way that sort of graphic novels and comics are getting a lot more respect as a medium, I think. Have you been sort of noticed that yourself in terms of the way that it has become from this sort of side thing that, oh, kids read comics and kids look at that, to now people are really embracing, the way I see it, the graphic novel and the comic as a very deep art form. Is that something you're seeing?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. The change since the turn of the century, or I don't know if they say that about the 2000 now.
Let's go with yes.
It was always Victorian England at the turn of the century. but since that time, and we had the advent of, and I think it can be squarely placed upon the shoulders of the Spider-Man movies, where people suddenly saw that that comic books aren't fantasy. They are, of course, but there's a deeper story behind them, behind good comics. And a character like Peter Parker, who was flawed, he's a teenager, he's got problems with his girlfriend and his best mate and all this stuff. It's almost like, you know, Superman was there for ages of Batman, and they're these undying, never-ending heroes. And then, but then you see the flawed characters of the Marvel Universe, where everyone's got day jobs, and superheroing is something that they've got to fit into their lives, and how it shapes their lives and moves their lives around, not always for the good. That I think people suddenly realised, oh, you know, I'd never picked up, but having watched the movies, I get it now. And so they're not just for kids, you know. Whereas people go, oh, it's superheroes, they're not real, it's pure fantasy, so therefore it's for kids. Now they can go, oh, well, for me, because, you know, I can relate to that character, you know. And, you know, whether it's your superhero is, or your superpower is, you know, just being good at soccer or whatever, I think that the acceptance, the broad acceptance for comics has come up, especially now that comic book stores are so prevalent, and comic book movies, like there's a new one every week. And yeah, so I think that acceptance has, it hasn't changed anything. And instead, comics can now spread their wings, and the amount of comics out there is just unbelievable with in any kind of genre. You know, it's not just superhero stuff anymore. To be honest, I don't really get into the superhero stuff much. I prefer the autobiographical tales, or the tales where people are just, you know, living their lives, you know, and something happens or whatever. I find that stuff really, really interesting.
As a fellow nerd and super fan, I get exactly where you're coming from on that. And for me, the other thing that has come with that is a rise of a lot of the Japanese stuff as well, and the prevalence of that and their storytelling. Was a lot deeper than some other comics early on, and a lot of graphic novels and artists sort of followed that pattern along. And I think that the sort of the diversity now with the, it's one of the benefits I've seen of globalization, is the whole, you know, Japanese stuff coming out into a wider market and people reading translations and going, wow, this is incredible stuff.
Yeah.
It tells such a great story visually as well on the page.
Yeah, absolutely. You look at, you know, Ghost in the Shell or Akira or something like that, which were made into mainstream movies, and you know, the manga influence is enormous now. It's out of control almost. And you know, you look at even now, just where it's bleeding into Hollywood, where you see films like Transformers or Pacific Rim, which are, you harken straight back to old Japanese stuff. But beside that, there's also your other countries where you know, in Japan, the cartoonists are rock stars over there. You know, they can't go down the street without getting mobbed, which is just unbelievable to me. but you know, you look at countries like Belgium or France, where graphic novels or bandes dessinées have been so popular for so long, that they're a culture in themselves over there. And they have whole festivals, and again, you've got rock star cartoonists. You know, you look at a guy like Hergé, say, with Tintin, or Goscinny's Asterix, you know, where these things have been around for 50, 60 years.
I mean, they're the two that I grew up on, and I read every one of those cover to cover. And that's, for me, whereas, as you've said before, a lot of the graphic novel and the art and the visual side of things gets, oh, that's for kids. That was what got... You know, I was already a fairly avid reader, but that was what really kept me an avid reader through that period where a lot of kids drop off, was that storytelling with the visual element linked into it. And the humour that I think is a lot more with that too. So there's a realism, but also a humour that gets thrown in naturally in comics.
And now it's part of the English New South Wales syllabus as well, so that helps too.
And back to Farside, whenever you're looking at the New South Wales syllabus in anything, there's always a Far Side comic. I do Society and Culture. There's a Far Side comic for everything in that syllabus. And it's required reading for the kids, and they get it. And it's what they can still. And I think it's something that kids are picking up more and more. And I think, as you said, the comic book movies have also played into that too.
Yes. I found when I was growing up and reading Tintin or Asterix, it gave me a different perspective on how other people in the world think. You know, like, because hang on, this story isn't told the way that like British comics are or Ginger Meggs is. These are different. People have different habits. You know, you don't see. I saw people being portrayed as drunk in Tintin, you know, Captain Haddock or whatever, and in Asterix, and yet you didn't see that here. You know,
there's no got in him. All those Britishers fight like madmen. You know,
Oh, the old Commando comics. Commando comics. Yes. Got in Himmel. Brilliant.
They're absolutely brilliant. Have you heard? Danielle's going to be funny here, going, what Commando? Commando comics are awesome.
What my brother used to call them, yippee dits.
They are.
But that was more referential to the cowboy ones. We had stacks of them, and you just read them. Spend a whole afternoon just going through one after the other. Always the same story, you know, you've got to fix the Nazi problem or whatever. And the Tommies would always win, and somebody would take a bullet and be all heroic about it or whatever.
And the Germans would react badly.
Yeah, but it glorified the soldiers, but it didn't glorify war.
No.
That was what I found the most compelling about it, is everything to date had been like, oh, how heroic war is. But these made it, they were, there was a very, a point to be made in them that war is just horrible and stupid and pointless, and the waste that comes of it.
They were unusual because there was a development of message in something that most people just considered throwaway pulp for boys.
That's right. And I think it worked because they didn't treat their audience like idiots. You know, when you read, say, Biggles or whatever, you can fall into that trap where it's just what a boy's adventure, you know, we'll get the hun.
Tally-ho.
You know, but in Biggles, you know, he had his dark framed thoughts about war and stuff. But in the end, it was all about how great are the British and how glorious war is. And I think, that's where that hasn't endured for me, or indeed for the audience. But something like the Commando comics are still getting read. They're still getting printed.
So you have a long list of credit, Jules. You've got a writer, you're a poet, freelance artist, script writer, comic book illustrator, teacher, Disney animator, a really well-known illustrator of children books with heaps of series from Weedo, Kaboom Kid, Leo da Vinci, Helix. For you, is it about the need to be the creator of art rather than just a writer or an illustrator, or is there one that you prefer?
More than all of those things, I'd almost prefer to be called a storyteller. Mm-hmm. if it didn't sound so like mystical or pretentious, you know. all those things of they're all just ways of doing the same thing, you know. Yeah. They're all just ways of telling a story, and that's I think my most compelling reason for doing what I do is to tell stories, and I love to be told stories as well, you know. Like I prefer in music, you know, that's why I'm a big fan of like Tom Waits and Nick Cave, because they're telling me a story every time they write a song. Paul Kelly's great as well. And Tex Dodd and Charlie and people like this who have there's a darker bite to them. And there's a darker tale to be told. And it's not a mainstream tale, because I've never been interested in mainstream tales. I don't find them all that interesting. I like these sort of darker tales. You know, I'm not a gloomy person or anything, but it's just that's the kind of stuff that I like. I like to, because I like to be empathetic in a story. I like to put myself in the position and experience somebody else's life that way. And so I think that in a very roundabout fashion to answer that question, it doesn't matter to me necessarily which part I'm doing, as long as I'm doing it. You know, and I think, but of all things, you know, I love to do the writing most of all. A friend of mine, who's a brilliant artist, Kanan Graal, he once said to me that he thinks of himself as a writer who draws rather than an illustrator or cartoonist. And I really liked that. Mm. And I like to tell myself and tell others that that's kind of how I see myself as well, occasionally. Is just a writer who draws, and sometimes I'm just drawing to, you know, pay the rent or whatever. So, did that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I was thinking when you are working with, you know, Ando or David Warner or whoever you're working with on those children's books. How much of a collaborative process is it? Because I know from reading, for example, Weedo, the visual images tell as much as the story, sometimes if not more than words.
Yeah, well, there is collaboration, but there's oftentimes I'm just allowed, you know, they wind me up and let me go, and I prefer that, to be honest. I like to get an idea of what the author is talking about, but I think if the author has done their job well, and of course they are doing their job well enough to get published, then I simply draw what they're telling me to draw in the story. And so there's not a need per se for collaboration. I mean, obviously you get together and you meet with the guy and you talk about it and you have a production meeting over it, but more or less I then just take it away and, I'm just working on it on my own. Mm-hmm. Very, very occasionally, I'll get somebody call me up and say, oh, look, can you show us what you've done so far? And, you know, I just want to check that you're on the right page and all this sort of stuff. But more or less, it's I get, like, for example, I was doing a couple of books, and it was the first book I'd done with this publishing house, and they gave me instruction as to what they wanted drawn. And so I drew it and delivered exactly what they asked for. And then the second book came along with them, and they gave me the script and said, what do you want to draw in this? And I told them what I wanted to draw, and they said, that sounds great. Go ahead and draw it. And so by the third book, it was just draw whatever you like. They didn't
want to see. So you've earned that artistic freedom.
Yeah. And it is nice to be granted that. Because it's, you know, it is part of my job to know layout and to know what's going to work in a story and what needs to be illustrated and what character needs to be shown here. Is it a close-up? Is it a long shot? You know, whatever. And so it's nice to be trusted with that ability because, again, that's part of being a cartoonist. You know, you can – just being able to draw nice pictures isn't enough. You've got to know how to lay out those pictures and how to make sure that they are telling the story in the correct fashion.
Well, I think Quentin Blake once said that for him, people get in trouble when they can't say what they want to do. And that's quite often when he thinks thought the illustrators and people who draw for books and artists get themselves into trouble in terms of their art doesn't work, is when they just can't say what they want to draw and make it fit what they want in their image.
It's like when I tell people about being a cartoonist, and a cartoonist is it's a broad term that encompasses both writing and illustrating. Otherwise, you're a writer or you're an illustrator, but as a cartoonist, you're doing both things at once.
Yeah.
You know, I used to work in, you know, with comic strips and comic books and editorial cartoons where you're not just drawing a pretty picture that somebody's telling you to draw. You're creating a story, and albeit in a single frame, or whatever, but that's as much part of the business of being a cartoonist as either the illustrating part. People just see the illustrating part, but they don't realize necessarily that it's as much about writing, if not more, than the actual illustration. You know, oftentimes I would be in my studio and I'd just be sitting there staring into space, and my wife would say, aren't you supposed to be working on something? And I'd be like, I am. You know, sometimes it comes to you in a flash, sometimes it does not, and that's just, you've just got to let that process happen, let it just wander around in your head, just running sticks along fences and stuff until it solidifies, until Tom Waits once said it was like fishing. You've got to sit really still and be really quiet and just be patient. And that's what he was referring to, writing songs, of course, but same thing.
Well, again, Quentin Blake again talked about, I was looking at an interview with him the other day again, and he was saying that a lot of his development and his creativity didn't happen in the studio, it happened looking out the window. And your imagination happens in the street, it doesn't happen in a confined environment. And so, yeah. Right. Are you working? And he's like, I'm looking out the window. Yeah,
I'm hard at it.
Yeah. Yeah,
believe me.
This is the coalface.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good excuse if you're just goofing off.
I'm working.
I'm working very hard.
I'm creative.
I'm sweat.
Tell us about your work as a Disney animator for the program The Proud Family. That sounds quite different to all the other work that you do.
Yeah, I'd been up in North Queensland, and I came down back to Brisbane. And I was sort of at an impasse in my life. I didn't feel that I was illustrating. I felt that, you know, my style was developing and all that. I wasn't ready to go out full-time solo yet. And I wanted to, you know, there's not a great deal of options for people who want to improve their drawing when it comes to tertiary education. So I decided I'll get into animation. That's always something that's interested me. I've always been a fan. So I did a certificate 3 in animation, then a diploma. And then once I'd done that, I got a job in a Brisbane company that was doing the show. They subcontracted a Disney program called The Proud Family. And I thought, yay, great. I'm straight out of college, straight into a job doing animation. How cool. And this was back in the days before CG. CG was a thing, but it wasn't widely done yet. This was like 2000, 2001. And so I set to work doing this job and went to a whole bunch of guys who I'd just gone to college with. They all got on board as well. It was a new contract that this company had. And we drew all day. And in the end, I ended up in backgrounds because of my inking ability. I'd done comics, and a lot of my folio was black and white, which still is my preferred medium today. So they said, look, we need one person who's the inker to ink backgrounds, because the way that they had the backgrounds, the pencil artwork for the animation could be scanned as it was, but the background, because they had to offset the line work against some filter they used to make the backgrounds, they needed one inker. So they hired me as the inker. So I worked in backgrounds where I was illustrating or cleaning up other people's drawings, which was fine. I really enjoyed it. And then I did that for a year, and my old college asked me to come back as a teacher, and that's after the contract expired. I don't know if they renewed it or they weren't renewing it or whatever, but the contract expired and I didn't really care. I was kind of over animation by that stage, so I went out, and that's when I decided to go freelance, and I started out on my own. So but it was a great experience, and I'm really pleased that I did it. I've never even seen the show, though, because it wasn't – I don't watch TV, so it wasn't
– wasn't dark enough.
It wasn't dark enough, yeah.
Right. I must say I did look for it, and I couldn't find it, so it's comforting to know that you couldn't find it either.
You know, the only person who has seen it, though, is Mother.
In truth, she did. It was running on Channel 7 in the mornings for a time, and she taped a whole bunch of them for me.
There you go.
So she taped those for you, but didn't read the book.
She redeemed herself.
She gave me this videotape filled with cartoons that I had worked on, but I had no idea how to operate it or how to make it work.
By this point, you had DVD, and it was all gone.
Yeah. It was a Betacord.
It was a Betamax.
Do I put a crank in here somewhere? Or
what is this wax cylinder you've handed me? Edison? What the?
I really liked the comment from your teacher. It sounded like a bit of a report card in your first book, but she must have been a huge influence of you as a creator of art.
Oh, she was. She is the most wonderful person. She inspired me. I grew up in the country, and whilst she was from the country herself, she'd been well-educated and was well-read, and she had travelled the world, and she was just... She was like a little window out of the farming community that I lived in. And, you know, because I always felt a lot like sort of Luke Skywalker when I was growing up. Not the cool parts, but...
Missing a hand part?
No, not the cool parts, as I said. But the growing up on a farm, isolated, and all the action's happening somewhere else in the galaxy, you know. And here am I, stuck in this little town. So I sort of saw her as this beacon of hope. And she had this really, really great family. And I went and worked a summer at her farm and met all her family and stuff. And it was really wonderful. She was just a really inspiring person. And I always feel that a great teacher can, you might be with them for classes and whatever, but they can stay with you a lifetime. And she has and does. She's in my head. And I think about things, and I think about things that, and I think about how she would refer to those sort of things, you know. And I don't believe she's even a teacher anymore. She's retired from teaching, and she took a post, or at least when I got her to do the foreword for my book, she'd taken a post in Vanuatu or something where she was distributing aid money and working with charity because she's a wonderful person. So. Yeah, she was a major, major influence on me, and still is, I feel. So if she ever hears this, thank you.
That's wonderful.
Hopefully she does. So what's next on the agenda for you? Is there anything you can give us a bit of a sneak peek on? Or?
I haven't reached my end game yet. My end game is to be writing and illustrating kids' books for myself. I'm always happy to illustrate for other people, but I've still got a lot of stories that I want to tell. So it's finding the right publisher for me at the moment but the best part is working with all these great publishers that I do is they'll all take my meeting. So I get to pitch them stuff and show them stuff I've done, and then I get my rejection straight away.
You've managed the foot in the door. That's the starting point.
Yeah.
So wait 6 weeks for your rejection.
I don't have to wait those 6 weeks. So
no post box for you.
So I'm always working on a story for myself. I'm always working on stories and books that I want to see published one day. But next on the agenda, we've got Weirdo 11. Has just landed on my desk, so that series is going great guns. We're almost at 1 million sales now.
Wow!
And that's been only in the last 4 years, so it's been a huge series, hugely successful.
Incredible.
And publishers, they have this funny habit that when they have a machine that prints money, they don't like to turn it off.
crazy.
Yeah. So
I believe it's called the Paul Jennings principle.
It's the Paul Jennings principle indeed. The R.L. Stein, Quentin Blake, Roald Dahl, all these people who can just bang them out and they sell like hotcakes. So that series and I will be together until somebody up high decides that that series is done now.
We'll talk to you again in Weirdo 175.
I fear that everyone will be getting a bit of fatigue by then. But there's that, and I've got that's my sort of major project. At this time of year, everything's winding up, and Amazon's put the scares into a lot of people as well, since it's landed in the country. So the publishers are a little bit hesitant about their book lists at present. So we'll see what's coming up in the future. But you know, I'm not afraid to think that, you know, these books and stories that I want to tell. Maybe self-publishing is the way anyway. The old models aren't necessarily what's the true model anymore. Mm. When you can print on demand, when you can print as exactly how many, you know, if you went and 20 years ago, you wanted to self-publish a book or vanity press, call it whatever you will, you have to buy 10,000 units or 2,000 units, and all these people with thousands of books still under their stairs because they didn't know how to sell them or whatever. You don't have to do that anymore. You know, you can order one book, or you can order 1,000 or 10,000 or whatever, and so there's less and less risk for somebody self-publishing these days, and I think that's a very exciting thing. Then it also increases the amount of what's the polite word for it? Garbage out there, including mine.
Well, as Tom Lehrer once said, self-indulgence is better than no indulgence at all.
There is that issue, but I think because, as you said, you've already got all this work behind you, I think it would probably work for someone at the caliber.
Well, that's possibly true, and that would be my bank on it. I would hope that I could use that as leverage to flog a few units, if you like. but again, I haven't greatly thought a lot about it at the moment. I haven't really had a lot of downtime to consider what I'll do. But there are stories that I'm writing at the moment, and I've been because I want to write for kids, because I think writing for kids is just the most fun thing that you can do, you know, because kids get it. They're the bridge between adults and kids, I guess. But they're an exciting, you know, young adult, and not young adult fiction per se, because there's less illustration in that stuff. And I don't have any desire to write novels, but I think writing for kids, you've got so much potential there because they're open to anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll accept that there are unicorns. You know, they'll accept that there are dragons and flying things, and they don't care. They're not going to question you about it. If the only questions they ask is, well, what colour was it?
and if you treat them, and if you treat them with respect in the writing, they'll go along with you, whatever you want them to go with.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I never liked being talked down to when I was a kid, and I don't do it to kids now because it's demeaning. And so hopefully that's something that will come up in the future. But you know, I've only been doing books for 4 years, so it's I've got time.
You certainly do. It sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited to have you on. I've been a big fan. We're, you know, educators ourselves, so I've always been a big fan of your work.
Very nice of you to say.
And if you have any weird and twisted tales that you'd like to send me, I'm more than happy for you to mess with my head again, because I really like that.
Okay, well, thank you. Did you read the whole book?
I did.
Great. Well, you're the first.
Well, I'll make sure I put a review up on Instagram.
You can find Jules Faber at julesfaber.com, Twitter at julesthe4rd, and Facebook Jules Faber. And if you want to contact him for school workshops, contact Lateral Learning.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.